This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, and we're coming to you today, July 23rd, 2002, from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. We're glad to be with all of you in the tri-state region on WBAI 99.5 FM. Ralph?
Maya, writing in the New York Times on July 6th, Nicholas Kristof made the following comment, quote, "When Asia had its economic crisis in 1997-1998, Americans properly trashed its, quote, crony capitalism, unquote. But we suffer from the same affliction ourselves, and President Bush will not address the issue seriously because cronyism has been his way of life, unquote." Of course, cronyism is not particular to Bush and his family. The former head of American Express and Avis, Robert Townsend, in his book Up the Organization, calculated that approximately 5,000 people control what he called the commanding heights of the American economy. It's not just a question of the 2% that controls and owns 90% of the national wealth, but within that apparatus there is a specific ruling class which has been worked out in this book and with particular documentation as numbering roughly 5,000 people out of a population now approaching 300 million. And that, Maya, I think is the context for the headlines today, "Investors Snub Bush's Economic Pep Talk." With the Dow in free fall, "The President Says Conditions Are Good for Growth," and the Associated Press comments that the investors are not inspired. In fact, Wall Street veterans, according to the Associated Press, react to the president's remarks with scorn. "Sweet nothings," this is a quote, such as "the economy is fundamentally sound," or "it's time to buy," are so much empty talk, said New York investment strategist Peter Bernstein. These remarks reverberate down through history, like Herbert Hoover's rosy assessments when the country was on the verge of the Great Depression. And in the newspaper today, the San Francisco Chronicle, there's a reprint of an article from the Boston Globe by Sue Kirchhoff called "Economic Woes Hit the Agency That Safeguards Pensions," and it describes how the federal agency that guarantees the pensions of 44 million Americans is taking a huge pounding as the economy forces the old-line blue-chip businesses into bankruptcy. They calculate that $42 billion have left the market in a matter of weeks. Richard Gephardt, commenting about the current economic crisis, calculates that $7 trillion have been lost by U.S. citizens. The value of their pensions, the value of their investment holdings, their very future. $7 trillion.
And Ralph, this is especially worrying to the White House and to Wall Street because, as our listeners will remember, plans have been afoot for several years for the privatization of Social Security. Not enough to loot Social Security, but the plans have been to actually transform Social Security into a milk cow for Wall Street instead of having it within the safer U.S. Treasury bonds. Only Treasury bills, as safe as the U.S. economy will be, which at the moment is shaky.
Well, Maya, with all this prattling about rules of conduct and the proper way in which corporate executives should conduct themselves, it's instructive to note that the cabinet of this administration is composed of the following people: the Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman, the Director of Monsanto and Pharmacia, the Attorney General Ashcroft, AT&T, Microsoft, Commerce Secretary Don Evans, Tom Brown, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, Pharmacia, Motorola, and Sears, Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham, General Motors, Ford, and Lear. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson, Director of Amtrak and Philip Morris and General Electric, Interior Secretary Gail Norton, Ford and BP, Labor Secretary Elaine Chao, Northwest Airlines, Clorox, and Bank of America, Secretary of State Colin Powell, America Online, Gulfstream, Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta, Lockheed Martin, United, and Boeing, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, Alcoa, International Paper, Lucent Technologies, Veteran Affairs Secretary Anthony Principe, Lockheed Martin, Microsoft, and Qualcomm, the White House Chief of Staff, Andrew Card, General Motors, Director of the Office of Management and Budget, Mitch Daniels, Lilly, GE, and Citigroup, and Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor, Chevron, Schwab, and Transamerica. These are not just investment relationships. These are executive directorate relationships. This is a cabinet of the ruling class. And that is characteristic not just of the Bush regime, but of each antecedent regime, virtually going back to the American Revolution, composed of the landowners, the corporate directors, the masters of the capitalist economy.
As we have described on prior shows, what we have in the state is a revolving door between corporations and the political apparatus. And for people don't know, Tom Brown is one of the major oil drilling companies, and BP is British Petroleum. So we have within the Bush cabinet Tom Brown, British Petroleum, Chevron, and most of all, we have Halliburton in one and the same of Dick Cheney. Last week, we discussed in great detail the cronyism and insider trading of President George Walker Bush, George W. Bush, the son of George Herbert Bush, Sr., who, as we've notated in many shows, has a close relationship to Carlyle and the defense industry and also the oil industry. Today we are going to discuss Halliburton, Dick Cheney, Brown and Root, Dresser Industries, the relationship between the state, corporations, war, particularly the current war in Afghanistan, the prior war in the Balkans, and the Gulf War, and the impending war in Iraq. How it all ties together in one and the same, Dick Cheney.
And Maya, I think it's appropriate here to cite an essay called An Appeal to the American Conscience by Bertrand Russell, dated June 18, 1966, and part of the book War Crimes in Vietnam. And in that that appeal, that essay, Russell said, "Many of you may not be fully aware of the extent to which your country is controlled by industrialists who depend for their power upon great economic holdings in all parts of the world. The United States today controls over 70% of the world's natural resources, although it contains but 6% of the world's population. The minerals and produce of vast areas of the planet are possessed by a handful of men. I ask you to consider the words of your leaders who reveal the exploitation they have practiced. The New York Times of February 12, 1950 stated, 'Indochina is a prize worth a large gamble. In the north are exportable tin, tungsten, manganese, coal, lumber and rice, rubber, tea, pepper and hides. Even before World War II, Indochina yielded us dividends estimated at $300 million per year.' And 1 year later, an advisor to the United States State Department stated the following, quote, 'We have only partially exploited Southeast Asia's resources. Nevertheless, Southeast Asia provides us 90% of the world's crude rubber, 60% of its tin, 80% of its copra and coconut oil. We have sizable quantities of sugar, tea, coffee, tobacco, sisal, fruits, spices, natural resins and gums, petroleum, iron ore, and bauxite. And in 1953, while the French were in Vietnam fighting with U.S. financing and backing, President Eisenhower stated, quote, 'Now let us assume we lost Indochina. If Indochina goes, the tin and tungsten we so greatly value will cease coming. We are after the cheapest way to prevent the occurrence of something terrible, the loss of our ability to to get what we want from the riches of the Indochinese territory and from Southeast Asia, unquote. The dynamics of capitalist rule, the we here, which is equated by the spokespersons for the U.S. government with the American public and with the American nation, this we is that handful of people, that ruling class, that crony capitalism, that structure of power that pervades American life and continues through American history and is embodied today as it was then by the current crop of corporate executives who represent the ruling class, and the we amongst them is the handful, not the people of the United States, not our country.
And as we will see today, the both the Republican and the Democratic Party are in fact tied at the hip through cronyism, through the combination within the boards of directors, through offering favors one and the other internationally.
Through the financing of the two political parties, equally by the great corporations, and through the changing of hats, no matter the administration, from one executive boardroom to the public trough.
And as the Labor Party said in its slogan, it's one big property party. Or rather, as we say, it's one big property party. And as the Labor Party says, the bosses have two parties. We need one of our own. Yet the unions to this day have not broken with either the Republican or particularly the Democratic Party. And as we go towards the elections in November, and it's already heating up as Dick Cheney himself is going around trying to shore up the Republicans who are up for election, what we find as we go towards the elections is that the unions themselves are increasing their coffers and preparing for what? Preparing to elect the very same people who are raping and pillaging the workers and also their pensions.
I think it's important to point out, Maya, that when we speak of the unions in this regard, it's the union bureaucracy, which has on the average, a 13-to-1 ratio of salary compared to the rank and file. The rank and file working population in the United States has vanishingly few illusions about either political party, and that's why when there's an election, a national election, about when 48% of the population takes part in those elections, that's 48% of the registered voters, not the eligible voters. It's sometimes as little as 50% of the eligible electorate that actually registers to vote. So we're talking about 25%. You cut it between the two parties, it's 12.5%. We don't even speak of the primaries or the congressional or senatorial elections when the turnout can be 19% and 20% of the registered voters.
Ralph, my head is spinning with these numbers.
Well, the point is that a fraction of the population is engaged in this process. For the most part, working people, I believe it's fair to say, hold their noses if they vote at all, and it's because it's the same old. It's the same lies, it's the same thievery, it's the same enrichment of the few and the pauperization of the many.
And that is why we need to construct a party of our own, a party of working people, a party based in the organized expression of the unions.
Well, that was the thrust and the intent of the Labor Party by the activists who formed it. And right now, of course, the task before that party is a clean break with the parties of capital, the Democrats and Republicans, and those of us who are engaged in this process of exposing the criminality, the fraud, the drug dealing, the BCCIs, the gangster capitalism, the suffering on the part of vast millions of people through the wars that are visited upon them and the desperate exploitation that they endure. When we point to these things and we show the structure and the institutional character of it, it requires a political response. We must mobilize our population, that great sleeping giant, the vast majority of our people, the working class, that knows instinctively from its own daily experience that it is being sold out and betrayed. It is not stupidity, it is not ignorance, it is not indifference. It is the absence of a vision of a political response, of a political alternative. We must build that political instrument of a clean break with the parties of capital. It will not come from the illusions of looking at Bushism, the cronyism of Halliburton and Cheney, without understanding that it is one big party with interchangeable components over the course of our history.
And now to look at that cronyism, because Dick Cheney is the embodiment of someone who believes that business and politics go hand in hand. Who is Vice President Dick Cheney? Dick Cheney had been the chief of staff for Gerald Ford when he was president. And from 1978 to 1989, he was the congressional representative from Wyoming. And while he was in the Congress, he was one of the co-sponsors of the measure to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to oil drilling. While Dick Cheney has no experience in oil, he has throughout his career been one of the prime advocates for the exploitation of the resources of this world for the oil companies. In 1989 to 1992, Cheney was awarded by none other than Bush Sr. for a place in his administration. He was the Secretary of Defense, and during that time, he was at the helm of the Gulf War, the war against Iraq, the destruction of the Iraqi infrastructure, putting Iraq back to the Middle Ages, as was said by the UN.
Yes, Matti Ahtisaari, the Undersecretary of the United Nations, in his report on the devastating bombing that killed as many as 200,000 people in Baghdad alone, the Indigel, the magnesium high-flaring bombs that sucked the oxygen out of the air, the desperate laying low of the entire infrastructure of Iraqi society.
Including the oil structure of infrastructure of Iraq, which will come into play again with Dick Cheney in his business enterprises. And what's important to note is that Iraq was the major resource for the creating the wealth of Iraq was within oil. In 1992, after Dick Cheney left the with the defeat of George Bush Sr. in the presidential election, he was on the became a senior fellow of the American Enterprise Institute, on which his wife also sits as a Lynn Cheney also sits as a senior fellow. It's a conservative think tank, and he went around the country lecturing until in 1995, and this is the significant part that's been in the news. He was awarded the presidency and the CEO of Halliburton. And while he was at Halliburton, he was also, as we were talking about interlocking directorates, he was on the board of Procter & Gamble, Union Pacific, and Electronic Data Systems Corporation, the massive data company that works for governments throughout the United States, state and federal government, that's owned by Ross Perot. Now, Dick Cheney's wife, Lynn Cheney, was also on the board of Lockheed Martin, the humongous defense corporation, which is forever, every day, getting hundreds of millions of dollars of contracts from the Pentagon.
It's billions of dollars, Maya.
Well, each day it's getting hundreds of millions of dollars, so it comes to billions of dollars. Now, let's look at Halliburton. What is Halliburton? It has now become the largest oil and gas field services in the world, a company in the world, which does the construction, the maintenance of platforms, pipelines, and refineries. So it's a full-service construction and management company, but it not only is involved in oil and gas, the basic resources that fuel the capitalist economy. One of the divisions of Halliburton, which was started in 1919, is Brown and Root, which is not only engineering and construction, and will come into play, as we see, in operations and theaters throughout the world, but it is well known for creating military field operations. And in 1962, Halliburton purchased Brown and Root. Brown and Root, and we will go into this as we have in past shows, is significant in terms of the privatization of U.S. military services, not the armies, but the construction of military bases, the protection of the pipelines, as well as the construction of the pipelines. And these are bases not only in the United States, but internationally, and includes the construction of the prisoner facilities in Guantanamo, Cuba.
You know, Maya, Brown and Root is now a subsidiary of Halliburton. An article was written by Robert Broyce in August of 2000, August 28th, in which he said that he described, this is in the Austin Chronicle, the candidate from Brown and Root. The man he was speaking of was not Dick Cheney.
Well, he was speaking of Dick Cheney, but he was speaking of someone else also.
Well, in particular, what this he starts his article by reference to Herman Brown's huge bet on the Mansfield debt dam keeps paying off. It made Brown a rich man. It secured the future of his company. It led to the other big projects that provided the funds to elect Lyndon Johnson to the Senate, to the U.S. Senate in 1948 and the White House years later. 63 years after Johnson enabled secure federal funding for Herman Brown and Brown and Root, the modern descendant of George Brown's Brown and Root is once again propelling a Texas political towards the White House. And the relationship between Bush, Cheney, and Brown and Root has considerable significance in the history of capitalism in the United States.
As Ronnie Duggar, who was the author of The Politician, The Life and Times of Lyndon Johnson, said, quote, Brown and Root got rich, and Johnson got power and riches. And it was without Brown and Root's money that Johnson wouldn't have won, or as Ronnie Duggar says, wouldn't have been able to steal the 1948 race for the U.S. Senate. Now, let's go back a little to the year 1937, and as Ralph mentioned, the Mansfield Dam Project, which was then called the Marshall Ford Dam, because Herman Brown, went and started to construct the project, even though it was illegal. And he did so because the Bureau of Reclamation, which was overseeing the project, didn't own the land on which the dam was being built. Now, this was just a minor fact for Herman Brown because he went to his newly elected congressman, which was Lyndon Johnson, and Lyndon Johnson then went to then-President Franklin Roosevelt, the hero of the Democratic Party, the man of the New Deal, who in July of 1937 made clear that he was authorizing the funding and the approval for the Mansfield Dam Project because, quote, he was doing it for Congressman Johnson.
And actually, Maya, that was that funding was considered to be the key to Brown and Root's future. In his biography, multi-volumed of Lyndon Johnson, and in the volume The Path to Power, Robert Caro, the biographer of Lyndon Johnson, reports that Herman Brown and his brother made an overall profit on the dam alone of $1.5 million, which was double the profit they had made in 20 previous years in the construction business, but they weren't finished there. A whole series of federal projects were channeled then by Roosevelt and Johnson to Brown and Root. Out of the subsequent contracts for dams, writes Caro, they piled upon that first million millions upon millions more, the base for a huge financial empire that was generated in that deserted Texas gorge. And the Brown and Root, which is at the heart of the great military contract of Halliburton, continues to be at the center of American capitalist affairs through Dick Cheney and Halliburton. But let it be said that it is Brown and Root, from Johnson and Roosevelt to Kennedy and Johnson, it is Brown and Root that did all of the major construction, from the
roads, the landing strips, the harbors, and the military bases, from the demilitarized zone to the Mekong Delta during the Vietnam War, were built by none other than Brown and Root, thanks to the good offices of President Lyndon Johnson.
The strategic hamlets, the infrastructure of the devastation and the occupation and the the criminal war in Vietnam, the money that was being made channeled through Brown and Root, the construction that was involved, Brown and Root, and that goes right to the role of the Central Intelligence Agency, the role of Air America, and the smuggling of heroin out of Laos and out of Indochina, which has been so amply described by Alfred McCoy in The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, the link between drugs and Brown and Root, the link between drugs and Lyndon Johnson, between drugs and Richard Cheney, between drugs and American capitalism, that $500 billion of laundered money that processes itself through every major banking institution in the United States, indistinguishable from the workings of finance capital and the wars it wages. We've talked about BCCI, we've talked about the Nugan Hand Bank of Australia, these criminal operations for laundering money and arms and covert operations. They are right at the heart of finance capital and the political structure of both parties in the United States.
So the company, Halliburton, that Dick Cheney took over in 1995, was already integrated with both the Democratic and Republican power structures. As I said, Brown and Root had been purchased in 1962 by Halliburton. And what Cheney did while he was CEO of Halliburton, the revenues of Halliburton, one of the largest companies in the world, rose from $5.7 billion in 1994 to almost $15 billion in 1999. And in 1999, it had 100,000 employees, 7,000 customers in more than 120 countries worldwide. And it was the largest private employer in Texas, and we have also to say it is a non-union employer, one of the major non-union employers in the United States. Now, how did Cheney do this? When Cheney came in, he said to the Panhandler Producers Royalty Owners Association annual meeting, "You've got to go where the oil is." And he, according to Business Week, quote, industry insiders say Cheney's political profile played a major role in helping Halliburton snag such contracts, and they were referring to a $2.5 billion deal in Brazil, and continuing with the quote, and expand its international business, which now accounts for 70% of revenues. Now, one of the people quoted by Business Week is Robert S. Trace, the Senior Vice President for All Oil Services Equity at Hibernia South Coast Capital, Inc. in Houston. And he says of Cheney, from a political standpoint, Cheney is a master. He was able to open doors for Halliburton in international markets, particularly in the Middle East, where previously Halliburton had been locked out. He was able to set up a meeting with the king of a country, as opposed to the king's second cousin. Now, we've mentioned that Cheney had no experience in the oil business, but he didn't need it. As David Lazar, who had been the former president of Brown and Root, the subsidiary of Halliburton, and is currently the Halliburton CEO, taking over after Cheney left, as David Lazar told the Baltimore Sun, quote, "You don't spend 20-some-odd years in Washington without building a fairly extensive Rolodex," end quote. And it wasn't just 20 years in Washington. It was 20 particular years involved throughout the Gulf, in the Gulf War, and going for George Bush Sr. to Saudi Arabia after the Gulf War to make the arrangements for the permanent military bases in Saudi Arabia, and it was as the Secretary of Defense.
Maya, it's, as Yogi Berra would say, deja vu all over again. The unauthorized biography, the book George Bush, the unauthorized biography by Webster Tarpley and Anton Chaykin, documents very thoroughly the relationship between Brown and Root and Brown Brothers and the antecedents in the workings of W.A. Harriman and Company.
Excuse me, Ralph. It's not Brown and Root. It's the he's referring to the antecedents of Dresser. Industries, which we'll get into in a moment.
Yes, but Dresser Industries and Brown are the tie-in here. In 1924, the venerable firm of W.A. Harriman & Company, run by Averill Harriman of the railroad fortune and of the banking, including who would become the future governor of New York as a liberal Democrat, started an investment subsidiary called Union Banking Corporation. Its first president was a longtime family friend, George Herbert Walker, the maternal great-grandfather of the President of the United States, George W. Bush. The new company sold over $50 million of German bonds to American investors, and in 1926, George Walker made his son-in-law, Prescott Bush, the paternal grandfather of the President of the United States, George W. Bush, was made in 1926 the vice president of Harriman & Company, president of Union Banking in 1929, when Harriman bought Dresser Industries that supplied oil pipeline couplers to the Rockefeller-owned Standard Oil, and Prescott Bush became the director and chief financial officer for Dresser. In 1931, in response to the worldwide economic depression, causes of which are rather similar to what we are witnessing today, the cooking of the books, the borrowing of vast sums of money, the fictive capital, the speculative investment, the concealing of the loss of real assets and of real earnings until the bubble burst. Harriman & Company, in response to the Depression of 1931, merged with the British investment firm Brown Brothers to become Brown Brothers Harriman. Averill and George Walker then arranged for Prescott Bush to become the senior partner in the new firm.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, listener-sponsored radio, and on the Internet at www.wbai.org. Today we are discussing cronyism in the...
Crony capitalism,
and an ongoing series that we've been doing for the last several weeks. If you'd like to reach us in order to get a copy of this or any of our other programs, which are now available on audio tape or CD, you can write to us at Veritas, V-E-R-I-T-A-S 9, that's the number 9, Veritas 9 at PacBell, P-A-C-B-E-L-L dot net. Or you can write to us at Veritas Press, Post Office Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. And our phone number is 707-552-9995. We'll repeat these at the end of the program also. So to continue with this, what we have now is we see the combination of Dresser, which was the Dresser Industries, connected to the Bush family for many generations, connected to Averill Harriman, the leader of the Democratic Party, who with his wife Pamela selected many of the Democratic Party presidential candidates, including none other than Bill Clinton. And we see the combination of Dresser Industries, which later the arrangement was made by Dick Cheney for Dresser Industries to merge, to be bought out in a over $7 billion purchase by Halliburton. It was considered the crowning glory of his career at Halliburton, and at this moment is possibly going to lead to bankruptcy filing by Halliburton, as we, according to what the predictions of the RAND Corporation. Ralph?
Maya, these relationships, which are characteristic of capitalism, because by definition, capitalism is a matter of cronyism, it's a very interrelated ruling class. We were describing how Brown Brothers became Brown Brothers Harriman, and George Walker arranged for Prescott Bush to become the senior partner. It's instructive to note that in the 30s, Walker took over the North American operations of the Hamburg America Shipping Line under the auspices of Walker's American Shipping and Commerce, which had shared offices with Union Banking. And in his book, All Honorable Men, James Martin described how these very insurance companies and shipping companies were monitoring the movements of U.S. troops during the Second World War and transferring all that information to the German high command. Indeed, there was a very, very incestuous relationship between German and American finance capital that began in the 20s and continued right through World War II. The directors of the company we're describing were Averill Harriman, George Walker, and Prescott Bush. It was called a holding company called the Harriman 15 Corporation and was run out of George Walker's office. And indeed, in 1933, when Hitler officially started his new order and Standard Oil appointed a Texas oil man named James Stamp Farish as his chairman, Farish moved to New York, where he began a business relationship with the chairman of the German industrial giant I.B. Farben. Indeed, Farish began hiring Nazi crews for Standard Oil tankers and appointed Emil Heifrich as chairman of the Harriman Walker Bush-owned Hamburg America line as chairman of Standard Oil's German subsidiaries. The relationship between the U.S. and the German ruling class is intimate, and it is characteristic of how crony capitalism works across national frontiers, where interests are defined in terms of profits, in terms of imperial control. Over the next 2 years, Standard increased its connection to I.B. Farben by completing major stock transactions, and then they hired the firm of Sullivan and Cromwell to bury the funds. Sullivan and Cromwell assigned a young lawyer named Alan Dulles to represent its interests, the future director of the Central Intelligence Agency, the brother to the future Secretary of Defense. The relationships become fairly clear. The relationship of Farish to the Nazi operations and to the Harriman Bank continues right through the war, and indeed there was an investigation when it was stated in Congress that Prescott Bush was running a Nazi front group. These are the characteristics of a crony capitalism that continues in its present formation through Brown and Root.
Well, back to Dick Cheney and the work he did at Halliburton. As the Washington Post had stated, quote, Cheney delivered fast, embarking on months of globetrotting that got Halliburton top-level attention from prime ministers and all sheikhs from Riyadh and Baku to Lagos and Caracas. And as we mentioned, the international sector of Halliburton became 70% of its business. As they continue in the Washington Post, soon he was on a first-name basis with oil ministers all over the world, building on ties he had developed in the Middle East during his Pentagon days. And as Winoa Hauta, the director of Public Citizens Critical Mass Energy and Environment Program, notes that the two largest government contracts for Halliburton are with the Pentagon and the British Ministry of Defense. Remember, Dick Cheney had been Secretary of Defense. He didn't have to even call up anyone in the Pentagon, because what he did is he hired Admiral Joe Lopez, and he had Lopez going around doing it for Halliburton. The Pentagon has been a huge boon to Halliburton, as Winoa Hauta says. Quote, Halliburton eats at the trough of government contracts, to such that before Cheney arrived at Halliburton, the company was doing about $300 million per year in business with the Defense Department. Remember, Brown and Root's work goes all the way back to the Vietnam War, and building of bases in the United States as well. But then the contracts expanded. It was Dick Cheney who hired, when he was Secretary of Defense in 1992, he hired Brown and Root to do a study, a classified report, detailing how private companies like Brown and Root could provide logistics for American troops in potential war zones around the world. Now, this contract to study the privatization of the military escalated from a $3.9 million contract to almost $9 million. And what was the conclusion? The conclusion was fund companies like Brown and Root. And in fact, it is Brown and Root that was funded. And they've won over $2 billion of military contracts since 1992 and expect another $1.2 billion by 2004.
Excellent.
They've been in Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Hungary, Albania, Croatia, Greece, Somalia, where they were the country's largest employer, Zaire, Haiti, Southwest Asia, and Italy, and also Rwanda. Little known and not discussed by most of the human rights agencies, Brown and Root played a critical role in Rwanda, and which led up to the genocide of the Hutu and Tutsis in Rwanda.
Well, actually, Maya, the relationship of American capitalism and imperialism to the absolutely devastating genocide that unfolded in Rwanda and Burundi is intimate. Wayne Madsen, who wrote a book called Genocide and Covert Operations in Africa from 1993 to 1999, documents the role played by Brown and Root. The U.S. Army Material Command confirmed to him that Brown and Root was in Rwanda under contract with the Pentagon. Brown and Root was behind the actual initiation of the insurgencies that led to the death of the president of Rwanda. A document on the plane crash that killed Rwanda and Burundi's presidents in 1994 was released. That plane crash on April 6th of 1994. Killed President Juvenal Habyarimana of Rwanda and President Cyprien Interahamwe of Burundi, and led to an orchestrated genocide. The document contains information which establishes that the acting president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, planned the attack on the plane. But Paul Kagame was not only an intimate of Brown and Root, but with the Central Intelligence Agency.
And no stranger, according to Wayne Madsen, to Dick Cheney. In 1990, during his tenure as Secretary of Defense, Rwandan strongman Major General Paul Kagame, then a colonel in the Ugandan People's Democratic Force, attended the U.S. Army's Command and General Staff College in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And Wayne Madsen writes, Kagame, with the likely knowledge of the U.S. Army and Cheney, suddenly dropped out of the school to assume command of the nascent Rwandan Patriotic Army, which later that year, in 1990, launched a full-scale invasion of Rwanda from rear bases inside Uganda. U.S. military advisors were present in Uganda at the time of the invasion, another fact that would have been known to Cheney and his Pentagon advisors. Now back to Brown and Root, because the a U.S. Navy demining expert told Madsen that Brown and Root helped Rwanda's U.S.-backed government fight the guerrilla war. Although the official task was to help clear mines, Madsen's research led him to conclude that Brown and Root was providing covert military support to the Rwandan Patriotic Army when it was massacring the Hutus, and also assisted the Rwandan Patriotic Army's invasion of the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Actually, what we're talking about here is the deliberate engineering of genocidal conflict initiated by controlled military units, both Hutu and Tutsi, answerable to the Central Intelligence Agency, answerable to the Brown and Roots. The Tutsis involved in a genocide of roughly nearly a million Hutus, approximately the same number of Tutsis killed, and special armed units involved in this slaughter. There are now 2 million Hutu refugees, and this was a process not only of seizing control of these two small countries, but of providing the basis for the dismantling of the Congo, which has been carved up with its vast resources, much as it was first attempted when the murder of Lumumba was orchestrated by the Central Intelligence Agency under Frank Carlucci, the point man for that operation, the key figure in the Carlyle Group of George Bush, and the mentor of a man named Colin Powell.
In talking about carving up countries, Ralph, I think it's instructive to look at Halliburton in Angola and the building of the oil fields in Cabinda. As well, it's instructive to look at the relationship here of the Democratic Party, none other than Madeleine Albright, going to Angola and supporting none other than Halliburton, while Dick Cheney himself was head of Halliburton.
Well, Halliburton and Cheney were very deeply involved in the creation and the promotion and the funding and the organization of UNITA of Jonas Savimbi. Not only were they provided with the arms, and not only were they provided with the funds along with the South African regime, but they were provided with the diamond traffic and the diamond trade. And even as this was being done at the cost of ultimately 2 million lives in the destruction of Angola, the Dos Santos regime, the government in Luanda, the capital, was then muscled by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to become an instrument for handing over the oil enclave of Cabinda in Angola to the control of Brown & Root, of Halliburton, of Chevron, of American capital. Angola, as Pratap Chatterjee described in his article for Corporation Watch, Dick Cheney, Soldier of Fortune, Angola is but one example of the United States government's support that Cheney was able to engineer for Halliburton. The company has a $200 million contract with Chevron and its partners in the enclave of Cabinda, where it services over 330 wells in 30 fields located between 1 and 40 miles offshore, which provides 8% of U.S. oil imports, more even than Kuwait. The concession is the source of 80% of the Angola government's revenue. The Angola government is now in the hands of Halliburton. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright flew out to Chevron's Takula oil-driven platform in Cabinda to announce that the Export-Import Bank of the United States was finalizing the loans of $100 million for oil fields and discussing with Sonangol, the state oil company, and Chevron was provided with a further near $500 million package to support the purchases of U.S. equipment. The relationship between the ruling class in its control of corporations such as Halliburton and Chevron and Brown & Root, and the hat they wear as the captains of the Defense Department, the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, the former Secretary of Defense, engineering these operations at huge human costs from Angola to Rwanda.
I recommend you look at on the internet, www.sfbg.com. That's the website of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. Again, that's www.sfbg.com. May 1st, 2002. An extended article by Pratap Chatterjee called Soldiers of Fortune. And it talks about what we've been mentioning on this show and others, the privatization of military operations, particularly the construction of the bases in throughout the Balkans, throughout Afghanistan, and also here in the United States by none other than Brown and Root, the billions of dollars in military construction. Today, I'd like to go into one particular instance because it ties into the wars for oil, and that is an article by Paul Stewart that appeared the 29th of April, 2002 on the World Socialist website, and it's called Camp Bondsteel and America's Plans to Control the Caspian Sea. Now, Camp Bondsteel, according to Paul Stewart, is the biggest from-scratch foreign U.S. military base since the Vietnam War, and it's in the Yugoslav province of Kosovo. U.S. forces seized 1,000 acres of farmland in June 1999 in southeast Kosovo near the Macedonian border and began construction of a military camp. Now, what this camp is vital to the oil pipelines and energy corridors presently under construction, and this is the U.S.-sponsored Trans-Balkan Oil Pipeline.
Which connects to the design that Cheney has outlined for the necessity to seize Caspian Sea oil and to control the pipelines. This is the root of the war in Afghanistan. It is the underlying dynamic of September 11th, the conspiracy, if you like, of this very cabal to terrorize the American people and to whipsaw the public into acceptance of a permanent war for control of Caspian oil, of the Central Asian oil, prepared in advance with the operations in the Balkans, in Yugoslavia, and in Kosovo.
So here we have Halliburton's Kellogg, Brown, and Root building the military base, supplying the military base, being the quartermaster, in other words, handling all the functions of the military base, functions that used to be in the hands of U.S. Army troops. And here we have them with this military base, one among many that is going to be along this corridor for the Trans-Balkan oil pipeline, at the same time that Halliburton's oil subsidiary, Halliburton, is also going to be building a pipeline.
But, Maya, the contract to serve as Camp Bondsteel is only the latest in the string of military contracts that were granted to Brown and Root. The fortunes have grown as U.S. militarism has escalated. The company, which is part of Halliburton, the largest supplier of products and services to the oil industry, now, as in the war in Vietnam, is the point company for the infrastructure of imperialism in every region of the world. In 1992, when Cheney was the Secretary of Defense in the senior Bush administration, it was he who awarded the company contract for support of U.S. Army's global operations. When he left politics and joined Halliburton as the CEO between 1995 and 2000, he deepened this relationship, and Brown and Root built and maintained the U.S. Army bases in Somalia. They built the support system for the U.S. Army in Haiti. It doubled their earnings to $103
million.
$133 million. The company received a contract in 1999 for $180 million to build the military facilities in Hungary, Croatia, and in Bosnia. Bondsteel has been dubbed the mother of all contracts.
And yet, the mother of all contracts is still to come, because Brown and Root has been awarded an open-ended 10-year contract with the Pentagon to build whatever base the Pentagon deems should be built by the Army or the Navy, and it is a cost-plus. That means that above their contract, they are guaranteed a 9% profit and an award for getting it done quickly. Now, we are nearing the end of this program. We have enough to go on for 3 or 4 hours into all the aspects and the chicaneries, the very nature of corporate capitalism and its relationship with Dick Cheney and his relationship also through this company with the Democratic Party and the Bushes. But we will have to continue at another point, and I want to, before we conclude with some relationship to the impending invasion of Iraq, to let you know that you can reach us at Veritas, V-E-R-I-T-A-S 9, at pacbell.net, that's N-E-T, or P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, California 94591.
Maya, we have been talking about the relationship between the crony capitalism of Bush and Cheney and Brown and Root and Lyndon Johnson, going back to Abel Harriman and those relationships. But I must say to you that one of the key elements in the entire operation was the relationship of Al Gore and Occidental Oil. When the Naval Petroleum Reserve, number one, in Bakersfield, California, was handed over under the guise of reinventing government, handed over to the Occidental Petroleum Corporation, which got a $4 billion profit bonanza. And this is not just any particular Naval Petroleum Reserve field. It was the Naval Oil Shale Reserve of Elk Hills. And the most instructive thing about that, because the Occidental estimate of the Elk Hills Oil and Natural Gas Reserve was so far below that the Gore-arranged $4 billion was unprecedented. But what is this field? It has a specific history. It was set aside in 1912 by President Taft as the emergency source of fuel for the U.S. Navy, and oil companies long coveted that field. It had a very particular history. That is the field involved in the Teapot Dome scandal of the 1920s, when the Harding administration's Department of Interior was bribed into granting secret drilling releases, and the Touchstone scandal of the 20th century, Teapot Dome, is the very field which, having been exposed when the oil corporations were literally looting it under President Taft, they accomplished it under Gore. Gore completed what had begun at Teapot Dome. It is the very paradigm of crony capitalism. It is the link between Republican capitalism and Democratic Party capitalism, the one big property party with two names.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen will be with you next Tuesday.